I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the woman who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Corp Cria, or Figure of Clay, read by singer, presenter and linguist Cass Izeji. Here's Mary to tell us more about Corp Cria.
Corp Cria is kind of an outlier in the book, I would say. It's the story of a girl who is living with a family in Skye, but she is originally from the Caribbean. She has been acquired by the family in Skye, and she is the slave of the daughter. Her name is Doll, and she kind of comments in the, or at least thinks in the story, that it's very typical in the sense that she was acquired by a child, and although she is now a woman, she's still called Doll. She's a sort of a possession. The words Corp Cria mean figure of clay, literally, or body of clay, and it's a kind of Gaelic tradition where you make a little effigy and stick pins in it. Everybody will recognise that. I think it's a common idea across the world. So you stick your pins in your effigy, and obviously it causes harm to the person whose hair you've embedded in it or similar. And Doll finds a Corp Cria, which is Gaelic tradition, but it reminds her of Obea, which is a kind of spiritual practice or perhaps justice-making practice that overlaps in some ways with some of the Western idea of magic, but practiced in the Caribbean. And Doll reflects back on her life there when she was still living with her own mother before she was taken and brought home to Skye by these people who are related to the owners of the place where she lived. It's complete fiction, except that a Lieutenant Sorle MacDonald, who was from Skye originally but had emigrated to the USA, that he wrote a letter. We have the letters in, I think it's the archives of the Gaelic Society of Inverness, of all unlikely places. And he wrote to the Brigate in New York. He wanted to take his daughter's slave with him on campaign. So he was a soldier. He'd gone to America and he was, you know, this is an era of many American wars. And he wants to take her on campaign, presumably to, you know, do the laundry and, you know, cook the food and so forth. So we know that a family originally from Skye owned a slave called Doll. And I wanted in what I wrote to kind of reflect on the fact that this sort of model of magic, a sort of satanic pact that was in use in the concept that was used to underpin the Witchcraft Act and persecute women and men too across Scotland, is only one concept of magic, and other cultures have other concepts of magic. And I kind of wanted to refute in a way, or gently push back at, the notion that Scotland's history is all white. And that I think we sometimes historically have ideas of ourselves as always the victims are always on the side right. And of course, Scotland's involvement in the slave trade is one of the big stains on our national character, actually, along with the witch persecutions. And so I wanted to write something a wee bit different. And I was very grateful that you let me, because obviously, as I say, quite an outlier among the stories. Doll finds the mannequin as she goes about her work in the upper floor of the house. It is made of wax and is vaguely human-shaped, and there is a gingerish lock of hair stuck into one side of it that looks like the master's. It has a pin thrust deep into the place between its legs. Doll's smile almost becomes a laugh at the sight, but she catches herself in time and closes her lips over her teeth. The master is well known for being free with his hands. He steers clear of Doll, but few other women escape his attentions. She tucks the little model back under the pile of freshly laundered linen where she found it, wondering who has taken it into their head to try a little magic. It has been years since Doll herself last thought of such things. She was a little over 7 when they took her from the shack where she lived with her mother and the other women in the fields and carried her, struggling and protesting, to the house. There they stripped and de-loused her and burned her clothes before her eyes. The fight went out of her then, watching every single thing that was her own go up in smoke. It seems to her now that she left a part of her first self there in the ashes, with the remains of her cotton smock. In place of the smock came skirts and bodices and complicated underpinnings, constricting and heavy, so Doll sweated and itched in the heat and had her hand smacked for scratching. Those were the least of the beatings. Scarce an inch of her remained unbruised as she moved through the first clumsy steps of her new life, dancing attendance on the niece of the overseer's wife. This Miss Mary was a girl of her own age, a puny creature, paler and more fragile even than the china poppet that was her most cherished possession. Of course she called her new slave Doll, and continues to call her Doll, for all they are grown women, and have been for years. "Effia," Doll whispers to herself. She has not spoken this, her real name, aloud, for almost 20 years. 3 small syllables, but so much lies within them. Grief for her long-lost mother and the other women, their fates unknown to her, and never to be known to her, in this life at least. A feeling of being adrift, 4,000 miles and half a lifetime away from her very self. And there is a small spark of rebellion too, flaring through the damp grey numbness of life in this place that is not her own.
And how did you first come across Doll and that letter?
I can't remember. I've known about the Doll letter for quite a long time. I don't think I learned about it at university. I spent a lot of time at university with my nose in the Transactions of the Gaelic Society of Inverness, because it's a great journal for, I was studying Celtic studies and it's a great journal for Celticists. But I don't know if I found out about it then or if it was later. I think perhaps I was researching, you know, Scotland's black history, and I came across it just, I think, by accident, but it always stuck with me. I've always thought there's a sort of almost a pattern to clearance happening here, people being sort of forced off their own land and then going off to various parts of the world where they almost then went on to be the perpetrator of essentially the same thing as had happened to them. And I find a lot of Gaelic poetry of the period a bit of a turn off because it's quite militaristic and quite, not all of it, of course, but, you know, there's a lot of Gaelic poetry of the era that I find maybe would bear scrutiny because it's the poetry of colonisation. It's just interesting thinking about how, you know, you can be the victim of a process and also the perpetrator of it somewhere else.
Although your story of Doll is a complete fiction, as you say, it's kind of evident that a lot of research has gone into specifically the names that you've called the characters in the story. How did you go about that?
I looked at manifests.
And I can't actually remember now where I found these manifests, but I found a manifest and it had a list of, you know, slaves going to a particular plantation. And I'd done a fair bit of research to try to understand where people were coming from to the Caribbean. So, of course, slaves were brought from Africa to the Caribbean. It's a fascinating period in Caribbean history because you've got Tacky's War has just happened. So that was a slave rising. And then you've got Nanny of the Maroons, Queen Nanny, who's kind of basically, she and a group of people who have freed themselves, they've got their own community that they're living free. But of course, in general, any kind of attempt at overthrowing the slave owner's power was met with absolutely horrific consequences for those poor individuals who were only trying to kind of have what we'd recognise as basic human rights. But when the book was published, actually, I was really lucky because the publishers just happened to have an editorial staff member who had studied, I think had while at university, had studied traditions of magic in African communities in the Caribbean. It was, you know, it was that kind of specific. So she had an eye over it and that was really helpful. But, you know, obviously, in a way, I suppose you're protected a bit in the music, but in the stories, you can, of course, get things wrong and I might have got things wrong. But all you can say is, well, I got them wrong in good heart and, you know, if anybody knows better, then just to shout. Imagine that idea, though, of having someone impose a name on you that wasn't your own. It's just a horrible thought.
Alone in the peat smoke dark of the room where she sleeps, Doll at last allows herself to open the door she has kept firmly bolted for a dozen and more years, and step into the past. On the other side, she tiptoes into the breathing dark of the shack in the fields, where she was begun. She passes the mat where her mother sleeps, her mouth open, worn out from a day's hard toil in the fields. Next to her mother is a woman whose name Doll cannot remember at first. But then it returns to her. Yaba. She was an old woman, or seemed old, but she was wiry and strong, and they whipped her once for demanding the doctor attend a sick child after she had twice been told he would not come. Yaba is cuddled into Doll's mother's side like a child, or perhaps a lover, her left hand cradling Mada's breast. There is a guard ring on her index finger, a fragile twist of grass she trusts to keep her from ill. Doll pauses a moment to blink back tears. Yaba is likely dead now, she knows. Mada too, perhaps, before she walks on. Her memory self picks her way carefully between the sleeping bodies. Ugolu, she remembers, and her daughter Chibundo, the next youngest to herself, until she reaches the place nearest the door where two women whisper and murmur, their heads bent together and their hands busy with some task she cannot see. One is Akua, who lives here in the shack, and the other a stranger. A third sits with her back against the jamb of the door, almost invisible in the shadows, but for the glint of her eyes. She is keeping watch, making sure no one can approach the shack and witness the transaction taking place inside. For Akua is an Obea woman, a purveyor of talismans to secure love and blessings, amulets to block harm. Obea was illegal in Jamaica then, and Doll imagines it is still, because Obea gives believers hope, and hope is a dangerous thing when a small group of men wish to keep a multitude in fear. Queen Nanny used her powers to stand firm for years against the colonists in the heart of the island, at last bending them to her will so they signed over to her the freedom of her village and her people. Doll was still in Jamaica when the slave named Tacky rose up with 500 and more followers across the island. Tacky was no slave truly seen, of course, for who is a slave truly seen? But a great king and a warlord in his homelands, and he had a fierce band of Obeah men with him. They say that Obeah men gave the fighters a powder that would render them immortal under the storm of the white men's bullets. Those fighters believed an Obeah man could never be killed, really believed it, and at the end the planter soldiers took to slaughtering the Obeah men and stringing them up with their masks and bottles and talismans in the hope that in this way they might break the spirits of Taki's men. That was when Miss Mary had told Doll her father was taking her away from the dangers of Jamaica and home to Skye. Doll spoke English then, but not brilliantly, and her first stupid thought was that Miss Mary was somehow going to live in the heavens. On a cloud, perhaps, although Doll could not see how such a thing could be possible. She had not expected that she would go too, thinking with a leaping heart of how pleased Mada would be by her return, at long last, to the shack. But Miss Mary was not to be parted from her treasures. The china poppet, her little dog, and her black slave were all to be packed up and shipped off home with her. Doll would find out that Skye was a place on earth, an island in Scotland, although it did almost seem they dwelled in the cloud sometimes, so misty and rainy and damp and cold did the place turn out to be. But the dream shack where Doll still stands exists in a time before all that, when Taki's war was no more than whisperings in a cave, or perhaps Taki was even back home in Africa still, making war against other people, yes, but fairly, following rules laid down generations before. Akua still risked a whipping if she was caught practicing Obeah, hence the lookout. But still the believers came, and somehow even in this poor shack, Akua managed to come by the necessary ingredients and implements to ply her trade. A skin of oil might vanish from the big house kitchen to make healing rubs or tonics. A rag might suffice to make a pouch of protection, or a handful of flour stuffed into an apron pocket might form the basis of a powder to keep old hag at bay, so that a babe might be born without killing its mother, and moreover, might thrive. There was a particular fear of doppies, the shadows of men and women that may be left behind when the person dies. Many rituals were recommended, many pouches made up of earth and hair, or blood or nail clippings to ensure the doppie could not cause evil or mischief to the living. Doll wonders now if she is a doppie of sorts, a shadow of a woman moving silently in dark corners, stepping on and on as if unaware that her heart is stopped, her soul gone, and really, she is dead. But then she decides not. The real doppie is surely Miss Mary. A woman without a heart, without work, without a purpose, but to acquire trinkets and possessions up to and including the humankind.
I suspect that the real Doll was acquired in America after they had emigrated. So my kind of backstory where Doll travels with them, where they've been in the Caribbean, they've acquired Doll, they've then taken her. And actually the story ends with Doll thinking about what it means to be going to a place where there are a great many enslaved people. And in a sense, that's a fabrication. But actually that Scotland-Caribbean link is something that we don't think about enough. And, you know, in your part of the world, Lauren, there's lots and lots of evidence of people coming back from wherever they'd been in the Caribbean with wives and children. So children of colour being educated, grave sites where, you know, you see that people had, you know, really had brought back. And, you know, sometimes it almost doesn't bear thinking about whether those were coerced situations, where they were free situations, where there was something in the middle. But fascinating. And we just have this very white idea of our history, I think. this fascinating conversation is about, you know, who was enfranchised, who was involved. And actually, it's huge layers of Scottish, although people were not necessarily voting for policies that were allowing these things to happen. For example, people were quite enthusiastically going off to hunt their fortunes. If you think, I mean, Burns thought about it, didn't he? When the affair with Nancy, Agnes Maclehose, when that all went wrong, you know, at one point he was going to go off and be an overseer. And then obviously had a massive vault fast and wrote The Slave's Lament and, you know, really saw that you can't operate like that.
That sort of idea of taking responsibility and documenting things, having monuments to or remembering in some way publicly these things that we've done as a nation, you know, the good and the bad, you know, and facing up to them and kind of documenting them in a really interesting way. I feel like other countries have managed to do that. There's some really interesting sculptures and things in Berlin, for example. It does feel like in this country, like we haven't really tried to tackle that in the same way and looked at our history in that kind of more critical way, maybe.
When you see it done, it's so kind of interesting. I saw years and years ago, I saw this quite little exhibition in which they'd asked lots of different artists to reimagine the wee Manny, the statue to the Duke of Sutherland. And they'd asked lots of artists to kind of, like, what would you do? And it was fascinating. Like, some people sort of said, I'd knock him down, I'd make him into gravel, and I'd lay him in his own shadow because he still casts such a shadow. And other people sort of had kind of quite jolly, that wasn't quite stick a cone in his head, but that kind of level. And then others had sort of more, like someone said, actually, I would like to carve all the names of all the people he cleared. I like the idea of those additive things.
Doll closes the door to the memory shack and decides she will begin her resistance against Miss Mary with the dawn. She will make her own pouch and will fill it with ease, for which of Mary's bodily leavings are private from Doll? Who else cuts her toenails, trims her hair, empties her shit from the night pot and wrings out her bloody napkins each full moon? One of Mary's kidskin gloves will do to sew the pouch itself, and she will moan and bewail its loss while Doll pretends to search, asks where she wore it last. Did she not come barehanded into the house last week, for she stopped to pick a posy of wildflowers on the way from church? Perhaps she dropped it then. They are to travel to America soon, Miss Mary says, where the master may soon be called again to fight in yet another white man's war. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of slaves in that land, Doll knows. And where there are slaves, there are murmurings and whisperings and plans for freedom. Miss Mary may yet live to regret taking Doll from this prison on Skye to a place where she will again find her own kind. And perhaps, just perhaps, she will find a way to shape a new self from the healing beliefs of her people.
When it came to putting this track together, it's quite a short track, quite a fast-paced and quite an intense melody, quite an intense arrangement. There's quite a lot of tension and unease in it, I suppose, referencing our relationship with this complicated history. It doesn't rest. The melody's kind of unrelenting and the whole thing feels quite unresolved at the end. Even the end of the track is still kind of still going. So without being, again, too literal, I think that was our intent with it, was to put that across. There's a real sense of unease with it. And when we're playing it, I mean, it's quite a hard melody to play for starters. It doesn't entirely feel like a comfortable listen or a comfortable play.
Yeah, and that part of our history is uncomfortable and yeah, there's a lot of tension in it. And yeah, hope we reflect that.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album. With thanks to Mary Kidd and Cass's Edgy.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.